Mr. Jealous, welcome to Explorations in Black Leadership.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
We generally begin with a question about the Brown decision, and you were born two decades after the Brown decision. But for you, what did it turn out to mean?
Well, I guess, the first memories I have associated with it were being on the desegregation bus. The irony is that I was the only black kid on the white bus. Yeah. In sort of the struggle that families have trying to make sure that the kid can go to a good school, a school where they can pursue their dreams. My dream was to learn about computers. It was early in the 1980s. I was headed into the fourth grade. And the only school that had computers was the black school two towns over. And so my parents were like, well, there's just no way. They're only putting white kids on the bus to go to that school from our town. My father's white. My mom's black. So my father said, don't worry about it. I'll just sign the boy up. I showed up at the bus, curly hair. And bus drivers kind of looked at me and said, just get on the bus. Just get on the bus. At a deeper level, as a parent now, Brown is a constant source of frustration. What Brown signaled to my mom when she desegregated her high school in 1954 in Baltimore was the end of separate, discriminatory, oppressive education regimes in this country. And the reality is that these days we have greater segregation in many areas than we did before Brown. We certainly have the greatest level of segregation that we've seen in pretty much all areas since Brown. And you have children who grow up with just as little hope of really being able to achieve their dreams as the children we saw in Kenneth Clark's Black Doll studies. Brown should be a great sore on the American conscience. It should be something that the entire country is eager to fulfill the mission of. And our role at the NAACP is really to make sure that the country doesn't forget its obligation to ensure that all kids have access to a quality education until that's actually achieved.
I've got some research here that says that you are quoted in Columbia College Today suggesting that while Brown led to the desegregation of many areas of public life, schools have been the exception. What about the other areas of life? Did it have an impact there?
Certainly. I mean, just the fact that we can like hop on a plane and not think about the fact that we used to be forbidden from many airports or relegated to different flights. We can get on a train and not be stuck in the Negro car. We can drive cross lines. We can work for any corporation we want to. Obviously, employment discrimination is still a reality. But when you look at just the way that life has normalized and so many barriers have been removed, much of that, if not all of it, goes back to Brown. Brown is a great success, but if the target of Brown, if the intention was to make sure that all children have access to a quality education and can go to any school they want to, we're a long way away from that.
So a success and a failure.
Yes.
Yeah. Who are the people who've been most significant in helping you become who you are?
Yeah.
Beginning with your parents, but I want to ask about others too.
Sure. I mean, my grandmother tells great stories, and she tells them over and over and over and over again, and they burn into your mind. And what that means is that you recall them sort of spontaneously. And her stories, being the granddaughter of a man who, in this state, was born a slave and didn't walk out of slavery until literally the end of the Battle of Appomattox. We actually have a newspaper when his wife turned 90, did a story on her down in Petersburg. She talked about Senator Ed Bland. He was born a slave in Petersburg or nearby and died a state senator here in Virginia, co-founded Virginia State. And my grandmother would tell stories about his life that she had gotten from him and from her grandmother. She would tell stories about her own experience challenging the white superintendent when she was a teacher to get a chalkboard that would actually retain the chalk so she could teach her kids. She would tell stories about going down to the jail in Baltimore where my father was one of the few white guys locked up for trying to desegregate the lunch counters and passing to pretend to be his mother. And these stories, and she would talk about the experience of walking down the street with my grandfather, with the police officer assuming that she was white, knowing he was black, and saying, "Ma'am, is this boy bothering you?" And her finally feeling comfortable enough to just sass back to the police officer, "Yes, but he's my husband." tremendous impact on me, and just sort of the dignity of being defiant. You know, seeing somebody who was absolutely the most dignified person I knew and had been defiant her entire life, and I knowing that my family had prospered. I've also been really fortunate to have a lot of great teachers. One of the things my grandparents did, one of the biggest favors they did me, my parents did the same, was to take me to dinner parties with them. You know, let me hang out at my grandfather's bar downstairs. While people passed through and talked about the issues of the day, and to engage me in those conversations. There was a judge in Baltimore named Bob Watts, who was one of the early black judges in Baltimore. And he would come into my grandfather's bar, and predictably the first question he would ask me every summer was, "Boy, what do you want to argue about?" And yeah, at the age of five, having a 6-foot black judge, you know, lean down, get in your face, and say, "What do you want to argue about?" Pretty much scares the bejesus out of you. But by the time I was seven, I was ready for him. And it, and that sort of comfort I got in the early age with talking to people who were much older than me about my ideas, challenging their ideas, having conversation, is really what prepared me to lead at a young age, because what you do when you become an organizer is just engage people in conversation and debate ideas with them, and they're often older or different, or you know, and so pulling me out of that comfort zone. I think the other thing it did, and I had a conversation recently that sort of struck me. A man said to me, he said, how many black male mentors have you had? It's another black guy talking. I said, about 20. He said, "Wow." I said, "How many have you had?" He said, "None." And you know, part of that, I'm sure, in his mind, it really was sort of an indictment of how we as black men treat younger men. I think in his mind, seeing somebody perhaps as competition and not. But I couldn't help but think that it was somebody had done a disservice to him when he was young and not teaching him how to learn from other people, how to engage them in conversation. And how to help, you know, and how to get other people, frankly, to help you sort through the decisions that you have to make about the path that we all have to ultimately take by ourselves, you know, through life. So I've been very blessed, whether it was Charles Tisdale in Jackson, Mississippi, the publisher of Jackson Advocate, whether it was Charles Hamilton, who taught me poli-sci at Columbia and co-authored Black Power with Soakley Carmichael, whether it's Dr. Walters, who's here with us today. When I was 20, I'd been kicked out of college and just found him with some other students where he was at Howard University teaching poli-sci, and he sat us down and explained to us what our responsibilities were to lead and to not wait till we were old and gray before we decided that we could lead, but what we needed to do right then. I've just been very fortunate.
You began talking about teachers in the lower grades. What experiences did you have with mentors or figures who pushed you and pulled you in a particular direction then?
You know, quite frankly, I had some good teachers, a good science teacher here, you know, a math teacher there who encouraged me. For whatever reason, I was also highly confrontational with teachers when I was a kid. And there's a librarian back home where I went to grade school, who she tells a story. She's now been celebrated as an expert in diversity in children's books. And she said it started because I walked into her library when I was 6 years old in the first grade and asked her for books on my mother's family. She kind of looked at me like, you know, this child must be crazy if he thinks we have books on everybody's family in this library. And so I went over and I said, "Well, you have books on my father's family." My father's family's been in New England since the 1600s, and indeed, some of them were actually captured in Willard's painting of the Spirit of 76, the little drummer boys, one of my father's cousins way back. And so she said, "Oh," and she goes off, "y'all, my mom's black." So, "Well, we have a book on George Washington Carver, and we have a book on Harriet Tubman." And I said, look, I don't want the peanut guy or the railroad lady. Mm-hmm. I want to know something else. And she realized, and I entered that all I was asking for was just a book on some other black person besides Harriet Tubman and George Washington Carver. And so she made sure that there were plenty of books. And I guess that was my first protest.
Mm-hmm. And it was successful. Yeah. And what about Henry Littlefield, who influenced Doc, you to go to Columbia?
Yeah, Doc was great. Doc really taught us. He was a man who, grown up poor, you know, white, poor in I think Brooklyn or the Bronx, who had sort of a bit of class rage in him because his father's brother had been able to go to college and had done better than his father had, and employed his father to work in an asbestos plant, knowing that asbestos would kill his own brother. And in Doc's mind, he was never quite sure when we talk about this, whether it was just simply that his uncle understood the necessity of having a job at that point in the economy and there really were no other options, or whether he just was so callous. I mean, it was who had contracted polio while at the Olympic wrestling camp and had defeated it simply because of his physical strength. He could lose that much muscle and still walk. Had gone on to serve in the U.S. Marine Corps and had ultimately discovered that his passion was teaching history and was also a pretty good actor on the stage for school plays. He was just this tremendous Renaissance man and person who loved life and who loved justice, and he taught us to believe that history lived and that we could impact it. And it was him and Bob Watts who convinced me to go to Columbia. I was interested because I wanted to be like Doc, and Dr. Littlefield was my hero. It was Bob Watts, however, who told me I had no choice. I told him I'd been admitted to Columbia. He said, well, then you have to go. I said, why? He said, because you want to be a civil rights lawyer, right? And I said, yeah. He said, well, Jack Greenberg is the dean, so that's where you're going to school.
And Jack Greenberg is?
Jack Greenberg was Thurgood Marshall's kind of handpicked successor at the Legal Defense Fund, mm-hmm. former head.
And he was dean at Columbia College.
Yeah.
Yeah. What about Carlton Long, what about Carlton Long?
Carlton was my first black male teacher. And it was one of those things you don't really realize what you're missing until you have it. You know, mm-hmm. you're just sitting there, you're looking at this man, and he's brilliant, and he inspires you to just sort of think about your own potential. And he taught me political science and theory, you know. So. And he was sort of this kind of Paul Robeson-esque figure, you know, mm-hmm. booming voice, kind of athletic presence, very forceful eyes. And so when he talked about philosophy that was 3,000 years old, the whole classroom paid attention. And he pulled me aside at the very end of the first semester. I had been helping him. I think that was a semester when he recruited me to help him what became Black Men for Anita Hill. Mm-hmm. he said, you know, Jealous, I think you would be a great candidate for the Rhodes Scholarship. I just came back a year ago. And I said, well, have you seen my grades? And he said, yes, you'll have to improve those, but there's time. He said, let me guess, you went to public schools, didn't you? I said, well, you know, through the eighth grade. He said, that's long enough. He said, I bet that they told you that an A was excellent and a B was good and a C was average, D was falling behind. I said, yeah, that's right. He said, and you're getting a lot of Bs, right? I said, yeah. He said, you think that's good? I said, well. He said, they lied to you. He said, here in the Ivy League especially, because we have this thing called grade inflation, here in the Ivy League especially, an A is on target, a B is falling behind, a C is an F. It radically sort of altered the way that I thought about my own academic achievement. And my own potential. And it would be some time before I could really put it into place. I ended up getting involved in a lot of student protests at college and community service and athletics and things that sort of kept me out of the classroom. But when I came back from having been kicked out and working in Mississippi, my friends were gone, and I really thought about what I wanted to achieve in my last 2 years of college. I decided I wanted to be able to pursue the Rhodes Scholarship because Carlton Long had put the seed in my brain at that point 4 years earlier. And it had sort of grown into an ambition. And I remembered what he said about grades. And I literally, my grade point average went from being a 3.2 for the first 2 years to above a 4.0 for the last 2 years, simply because he set the bar higher than anybody had set the bar before.
And what about Father Bill Starr?
Bill was like John the Baptist on campus. He had come to Columbia's campus in 1965 and had become sort of the spiritual leader. And he and Rabbi David Saperstein are very much peers. And they were both sort of spiritual leaders of kind of anti-war protests, and, you know, like the Berrien brothers and so forth. And but he had been on campus, and he nurtured a group of students who spiritually were very committed to the new commandment, whether they were Christians or not, but most of them were Reformed Jews, but whether they're Christians or not, the notion that really the commandment above all else is to love your neighbor as yourself. And whose politics very much flowed from a judgment based on, are we being treated with dignity? Are they being treated with dignity? And as somebody who also became a student protest leader, who was often at odds with the administration, who was dealing with stresses at home, his grandparents had to wrap their mind around the fact that their child's about to be, you know, one of the first students suspended from Columbia in over 20 years. He was somebody who really encouraged me to develop, I guess, a spiritual base to sustain myself. And it was when I found myself in Mississippi working as a journalist, getting death threats, I really came back to prayers and scriptures that we discussed with Bill, as he kind of allowed us to see the Bible and it's just a place of refuge for people who were committed to social change.
Do you remember specific events, either historical or personal, that were critical to your understanding of American society? But that's to say, even events from the Civil Rights Movement, or events in your neighborhood, or events in your family, things that made you think differently or think more critically about American society and the role you might play in it?
Yes, more critically of American society, frankly, just stories about the events surrounding my parents' wedding were transformative in my own thinking. Because it made it, your parents, as a child, really they become the most beautiful people you know. You know, they're just everything. And to find out that my father's uncle had driven down to where they were studying in Vermont to officially disown him on behalf of my father's grandfather, to explain to my father that he really did believe that my father loved my mother, but that if life had taught him anything, a man could love many women, and that if he wanted to stay in the family, he needed to get out of love with my mother. find out that they weren't allowed to get married in my mom's hometown of Baltimore at the family church, St. James Episcopal, but rather had to get married in Washington, D.C., because it was illegal. And that some people apparently pulled off to the side of the road when the caravan of wedding cars making its way back from D.C. to Baltimore, because they mistake it for a funeral procession. They just weren't used to seeing sort of, a limo and a bunch of cars and it not be a funeral procession. Or that my parents had to, ultimately had to find a place where they would be accepted to live, because it wasn't clear they'd be accepted either in Maine or in Baltimore or in San Diego, where they moved to first at that time. Definitely made discrimination feel very, very personal and I think more ubiquitous and overwhelming, just all the things that were involved in that than anything I experienced myself. You know, as a child, you experience those person following you around the five and dime or whatever, but you just pitied the person who followed you around the five and dime. This made it feel like a much bigger loss and loss of wealth and everything. My parents also took me to protests, and they talked to me about protests they were involved in the 1960s. I can remember my mom talking about the experience of making her way down to tent cities in Tennessee, where black farmers had been pushed off of land and sort of made homeless and had to erect tent cities on the farms of blacks who actually owned land, because they had demanded the right to vote. And what it meant to have to, you know, hide to evade the Klan to get down there and to get back, you know, bringing them supplies. You know, finally, I guess it was Jesse Jackson's campaign. I got very excited. You know, it was a time, between Jesse Jackson and Doug Wilder becoming governor of Virginia, the state that my family's from, that just sort of captured my imagination about what might be possible for my generation and what our cause was, and the experience of being 14 years old and putting together a team of folks who registered thousands of people to vote and helped convince a county to support that was predominantly not black, you know, white, Latino, and so forth, to embrace Jesse Jackson, took him from 7th in the polls to 2nd in that county. That was the first thing that gave me a sense of my own potential, if you will, for leadership.
Very quickly, in any of your school experiences leading up through Columbia, were you active in student politics, student government? Did you have any of those kind of leadership positions?
Yes, certainly. At Columbia, I ran for student council. So the first real protest that I led, I had actually put on, like every student council person, I'd put on my best Oxford, my best pair of pants, and just walked over with a delegation of students to convince University Senate, they should not abolish full need financial aid nor need blind admissions. We found ourselves locked out, and we ended up taking 50 students and turning it into 800, pulling students out of classrooms and climbing through a second story window. But prior to that, it had all been Key Club and Junior Statesman and Model UN and, you know, all the things that kids who sort of yearn to be in the establishment do to prepare themselves.
What about non-school activities like Boy Scouts and Cub Scouts?
I was in the Boy Scouts for a very short period of time. I had a scoutmaster in California who was from Alabama, and I was the only black kid in the Boy Scouts group, and it felt like that was an issue. Mm-hmm. But I also, frankly, had a father who was from Maine and who took me on adventures in the outdoors and, bouldering and hiking trips and that were way more exciting than anything that local Boy Scout chapter was doing.
It's surprising to me to have sat here and heard so many people sit where you sit and say that the Boy Scouts were a tremendous influence on their lives.
You know, Boy Scouts are huge. I mean, I look at my father-in-law, for instance. His father, there's two things three things are said about his father. One is that he desegregated the town of Denora, Pennsylvania's restaurants by himself with a pistol. as the head of the Negro Social and Political Club. The other is that he was a steel worker with a sixth grade education. And the third was that he was scoutmaster to a whole group of Boy Scouts who went on to get PhDs, to become judges, my father-in-law was a dean at the University of Pittsburgh for 30 years, you know, really sort of be pioneers in their fields. Mm-hmm. The Boy Scouts is a great institution, but unfortunately it comes down to the scoutmaster.
Yeah, I would think so. What led you to choose your career? Now, in your life, you've held a number of positions in your short life, but almost all of them are in the social justice field.
Right.
And that's unique, I think, for people who've sat in your position as NAACP head. They've come from a variety of backgrounds. But how did you get set on this path? What is it? Is it everything that led up to taking this first job that led to what you are today? Or?
You know, between my grandmother's stories and my parents' stories, without pandering, sort of events like Eyes on the Prize, my imagination as a child and increasingly as a teenager was very much captured by the continuity of social movement in this country. And, you know, again, you know, being born just before the bicentennial, a lot of my childhood stories were like my father talking about kind of, you know, in the oral tradition of his family, talking about what the American Revolution meant to the people who participated in it. And his family had been also leaders in the women's suffrage movement and had, you know, both been witch burners and founders of the Unitarian Church. You know what I'm saying? Uh-huh. So two ends of American Christianity, right? And so both from his stories and from my grandmother's stories, it literally went from slavery through Reconstruction through Jim Crow and right up to the present. To the present moment, there was just a notion that there was nothing more noble than a person could do than to help finish the American experiment and really create a pluralistic democracy that worked for everybody. There was also, especially my grandmother's stories and my mom's kind of spirituality and some of the conversations with Bill Starr, a notion that we were surrounded at any given moment by our ancestors, that there was a indebtedness that wasn't simply whatever you chose, however you chose to perceive it, but that there were actually people, spirits that were judging you. And that sense, sort of metaphysical sense of sort of responsibility and possibility. That you, on the one hand, you had to continue the work that generations had started, and on the other hand, that great changes were possible. Led me to a place where I really have considered no other path. I mean, it's just what I, you know, I've just kind of looked for how I could just help change the world for the better as quickly as possible.
And I know at one time in your life you wanted to be a lawyer,
yeah.
And you decided against that. What made you change?
Because all the cases that I worked on when I was at the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, as a summarizing depositions for lawyers, or even, you know, dealing with mail from inmates who might become members of plaintiffs or organizing plaintiffs in Harlem, all the cases were older than I was. Mm-hmm. And I felt like I had been sold a false bill of goods, you know. Mm-hmm. These stories about Thurgood Marshall, and, you know, and then there was the decision,
yeah.
And all was good.
Right.
And the combination of, you know, finding out that Brown versus Board was still an active case in the early 1990s because they were simply trying to enforce it in Topeka, or you know, dealing with death penalty cases, working as an organizer on a death penalty case that was, you know, 19 years and was what I ultimately stumbled across when I was invited by a legal defense fund lawyer to organize on the case. And the pace of good decisions by the court sort of quickened in that particular case, and then went down to Mississippi where the governor was trying to shut down a black college and turn it into a prison. And we were able to keep the school open, and the lawyer very much credited how we had changed public opinion, was that we could impact the court of public opinion much more directly, much more quickly, and could often hasten the pace of change in the court, if not change the course entirely. And that's part of what part of the theory I brought to the work at the association. We said the victory in the Troy Davis case.
I was thinking just about Troy Davis.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Tell us about Troy Davis.
So Troy, been on death row since the early 1990s, like about 18 years. He was put there by 9 eyewitnesses. No other evidence, no physical evidence. In those 18 years, 7 of the 9 have recanted, and 6 more eyewitnesses have come forward to say that one of the 2 who has not recanted is the actual killer, as do many of those 7. So you now actually have more people saying that one of the 2 people who put Troy Davis on death row is the actual killer than you had people saying that Troy was the actual killer. And again, 7 of 9 of those have recanted. Well, our lawyers, the lawyers, you know, representing the cause of justice and Troy Davis, said that there was a 1% chance, like even given all that, Troy Davis would even be given a hearing of the evidence because he had exhausted his procedural guarantees under the 96 Effective Death Penalty Act. And that the Supreme Court did nothing like this and had not ordered a new hearing of the evidence for anybody who had exhausted their appeals in more than 50 years. And so we decided, rather than, you know, hiring additional investigators or investing in the legal strategy, that we would do a big media strategy and a local community organizing strategy. The local community organizing strategy focused on the district attorney. our local NAACP folks, one of the advantages of the association, you don't have to do all the work by yourself, right? You call the state conference president, he calls the local president goes over and talks with the state conference president too. The DA says, look, I've heard from people in the Netherlands, I've heard people at Emory University, how much outraged they are about this case. I haven't heard anything from anybody in Savannah. So we put 12,000 petitions on his desk within 2 weeks. And in the same time, we went around to, went and met with the publisher of the local, you know, the shorthand, let's say the local white newspaper, right, the mainstream daily that historically had been a segregationist rag, but obviously has changed its colors in recent years, but who still had only covered this case as a cop killer case for the last 18 years. We sat down with the publisher and the editor, and the coverage improved, and they covered the petitions going into the DA's office. Same time, we did a national strategy from Bill Maher to NPR and everything in between. And we knew that public opinion probably wouldn't impact the justices, but it certainly would get the attention of their clerks. And that with the fax machine there at the Supreme Court with all these habeas appeals coming in, and they typically just kind of go into the trash can, that if we could get, if you will, to sort of capture the imagination of people in their 20s in this country who cared about social justice, people like Supreme Court clerks, that maybe one of them just grab it from the fax machine and walk it over to the boss and have a conversation. Well, in mid-August, we got word that a decision was likely to come down. It scared the bejesus out of us because the Supreme Court wasn't supposed to say anything until around September 30th. And oftentimes we hear about something in August, especially a civil rights case, it's just simply that they're clearing off their docket. And they're basically deciding against you. And so we kind of waited there with bated breath, and we won. We won 6-2 with Roberts and Alito on our side. And the lawyers, we're all very proud of them. They're very proud of the work. They did great work, but they couldn't explain it without explaining the change of the court of public opinion.
Congratulations. Thanks. Your experience as a Rhodes Scholar, you describe it as enlightening, but what did you draw from that?
It was enlightening in that it was demystifying. Mm. I had experience at the end of my time there where I was admitted to UC Berkeley's law school, Oxford's business school, and seminary without submitting any applications or even taking a test. They were just conversations. Now, granted, I happened to call UC Berkeley's law school when they just figured out they were going to have one black student for the second year in a row. But literally, the conversation went, hi, is this the dean of admissions? He said, yes, sir. I said, my name is Ben Jell. He said, I know who you are. One of the professors called about you. I said, yes. I said, well, anyways, I've missed the deadline for the global LSAT. I thought it was the same as the domestic one. I was looking at the wrong website. And I just need to know if you would accept a later submission of my LSAT scores. He said, hold on for a second. He said, you're admitted. I said, that's a part of me. He said, I said, what about the application? He said, by all means, fill it out before June, please, if you will. I said, well, what about the LSAT? He said, by all means, you need to take that too before June if you can, but definitely before you start. I said, really? He said, you will have the package next week. And I should have saved this for my children. It was years later when I really focused on just how remarkable it is to be admitted to law school. But and the other conversations were similar. I had, again, Bill Starr had really had an impact on me. And I ended up spending the summer, when I thought I was heading off to law school, working with him and with another Episcopal priest. And so at the end of it, I'd been toying back and forth all through college, whether it be a lawyer or a priest. I said, well, how long would it take for me to become a priest, you know, how long did I start seminary? Because I thought maybe I would do both or something. And he said, well, why don't you go talk to Father Castles? I went down the hill to talk to Father Castles, one of these other kind of white radical priests in Harlem. And he said, well, let me call the bishop. So he called the bishop, and the bishop told him it would take 3 years. And he said, Ben, will you just excuse me for a second? I said, sure, Father Castles. Let me sit outside his door. He cussed the bishop a blue streak, and then he opened the door. And he said, come back. He said, the bishop said you can start in 3 weeks if you want. So it was this notion, you know, that, I mean, because when you're a black kid growing up in this country, and, you know, kid with working parents growing up in this country of any color, you know, all of the hoops to get to where you want to go, you take very seriously, and you contemplate every leap through the next hoop. And to know that just for some people, they hit a point in this society where the establishment just opens doors was demystifying, to say the least. It was part of a year for me that was just simply exceptional. I had worked 30 hours a week all through college. In the legal defense fund, Jack Greenberg had arranged for that to be my work-study job. It wasn't like I was able to intern. I was getting paid 10 bucks an hour and needed the money. And being able to spend a year doing an accelerated master's degree program where I didn't have to work, where I could go to the movies as much as I wanted, where I could read as many books as I wanted and not be thoroughly exhausted because I'd worked 30 hours, was wonderful. But it ultimately made me feel like I was itching to get back to the States because I, for whatever reason, while I'm very sympathetic and often fight on global issues here, I really don't feel any need to be involved in the affairs of any other country. I want to make this country work. And so at the end of that summer, I ended up starting my year of discernment with the Episcopal Church, moving into a single room occupancy building for multiply addicted people with HIV that I was helping to manage, working with a priest. And I guess it was sort of, to me, it was like the spiritual antidote for the decadence of Oxford, but it was still a great year.
Look back over your relatively short life. Is there a point where you began to think of yourself as a leader?
Yeah, I mean, it was really at, in some ways, the Jackson campaign was an experience, but I stuttered horribly. I would write all my speeches, and I would try to read them, and I would just, it was painful for the audience, it was humiliating for me. So it was hard for me to think of myself as a leader. In my teenage vanity, I would look at the photos of the paper and think, I look pretty good, but I knew that the still photo was very kind. If you saw the videotape, it's a very different experience.
Let me stop you just for a second. So prior to that, in high school, in grade school, you never thought of yourself?
No. I was the short, stuttering black kid in the white school. I mean, I was exceptional and sort of on the outside in every sense. I was both, I was the shortest person in my freshman class. Young Japanese lady, Kei Gatanaga, was a good friend of mine. She was, I think, half an inch taller than me. And I can remember, she was 5'2", I was 5'1 and a half. Senior year, I was 6'4", she was still 5'2". I remember, never forget Kay looking up at me and saying, I used to be taller than you. all those things. And I'd also skipped a grade, so I was a bit younger. Just made me feel sort of on the outside. But when I got to college, and I was tall, and I was on the crew team, and the Gulf War broke out. When you're working 20, 30 hours a week and you're rowing crew 28 hours a week, you don't really have, and you're going to class, you drink a lot of coffee and you don't have much time for anything else. But I got a call from a friend back home who it looked like he was going to be activated. One of my best friends had gone into the reserves and I'd gone off to college. It was just like, sort of my father's nightmares coming back, right? I mean, one of the things you when you're a child of the 70s, you grow up with all the Vietnam War back and forth. My father had been a conscientious objector. He had registered me as a conscientious objector when I was 5 because Carter started talking about the draft again. He talked about the pain it caused amongst his friends as some were killed in Vietnam and stuff. And here we were. It's like the children of the Vietnam vets turn 18, and all of a sudden, literally, the Gulf War started on my 18th birthday. January 17th, I turned 18 on the 18th. And I found myself at an all-night protest downtown, trying to shut down the Brooklyn Bridge. And two or three students ended up jumping off the bridge because somehow a driver got through the police barricade on the other side and just came plowing into the crowd. And to this day, I don't know whether those students died or lived. I know that they fell about 70 feet, and there was conflicting accounts. I was towards the front of the march. It was one of the most devastating experiences of my life. And I ended up walking all the way back from the Brooklyn Bridge to Columbia. I'd given Columbia's campus. And a couple weeks earlier, I'd been harassed there, about a week earlier, by an FBI agent who was looking for Iraqi students. He thought I looked vaguely Iraqi. I went off on him. By the time I lectured about our family's involvement here from the 1600s, he just apologized. I gave him a lecture on white privilege because he said his family had been here for less than 50 years. So he just apologized. But I read a group of students who said that they were going downtown to do a sit-in in front of the FBI building to protest the racial profiling of students on campus. And I said, great. And I ended up spending my 18th birthday in jail. But coming back to campus as sort of one of these heroes, right, who'd been to jail and the protests or the Gulf War, and kind of being thrown up there to give speeches and having no time to write them because I'm working and I'm going to, and I figured out I could give an extemporaneous speech. And it was the first time in my life that I felt like, well, perhaps I can lead people and convince them of something.
First time. Now, remember, you're 14, and you run this voter registration campaign. Right. I mean, to me, that's exercising some kind of leadership.
Yes, it was, and it was successful, and it gave me a sense of my own potential. But I guess in my eyes, leaders were ultimately people who could talk in front of folks, large numbers of people, and be understood and convince them. And stuttering horribly made me feel like, if you will, I could be a good sergeant, but I couldn't be the lieutenant, you know.
But sergeants are leaders, too.
Sergeants are leaders, too.
What do you see as the difference between vision, philosophy, and style? Can you tell me how these three interact for you? Vision, philosophy, and style.
Style is something to me that you get from your grandfather, or you get, it's subtle decisions that you make about how you comport yourself, how you treat other people, how you dress, how you manage, how you respond to crises or to tough situations. Philosophy is much more intentional. Style, in other words, is an accumulation of little decisions you make throughout your life, and then you just sort of put on autopilot. Philosophy is much more intentional. It's the result of really wrestling, often making tough decisions, and committing to a way of life, a way of being in the world, a certain set of risks. Vision, in my experience, is what you feel compelled to do. It's in that sort of context of your philosophy and your style, which are, I think, ultimately quite deliberate, even if they're small decisions over time. These are decisions you make, philosophy, things you choose. Vision, and calling and, to me, are very spiritual and often spontaneous or, inspired. And in my experience, come with a sense of being compelled. That once you see something as possible, you see that it's possible to, in your own mind, to save the financial aid program, or it's possible to actually assemble a set of facts, perform the investigation as a reporter, to exonerate a man who's being framed for arson in Mississippi, or whatever. It's the vision that compels you to follow through. And that's, I think that's one of the things that has been great about this country, is that there's we accept a certain kind of prophetic tradition amongst leaders, white, black, throughout American history. The influence of religious zeal in this country is that we sort of tolerate leaders who are audacious, who put really big visions out there, and then who work, themselves often to death pursuing them. And we as Americans are willing to follow those folks. And that's one of the things that keeps us on the edge. I mean, you saw that with the Obama campaign. Clearly Barack Obama had a vision. It was, I think, objectively no more compelling than Ron Paul's vision. But he himself was compelling in the way that he pursued it, and in his individual belief in his vision. And that became infectious.
Has your vision changed over time? Is it the same now as it was when you were much younger?
Yeah. Yes, it's the same. It really hasn't changed much. My philosophy has changed over time.
Okay. How has that changed?
I'm just a much more tolerant person, a much more aware of what making a decision to pursue a certain path, to coalesce around a common goal, takes from any specific individual. When I was a child, I really thought that things were quite simple. While I still, I think my vision for this country is a fairly simple vision for this country. It's elimination of barriers and increase, sort of tightening of the social safety net. I see both, it's a more understanding of people's limitations when they won't join me, and I'm also more aware of the fact that people that the people who are wrong in like 9 out of 10 things are often right and willing to join you for that 1 out of 10. I mean, I had an experience recently with an executive, and we were talking about getting his company to change its policies on with regards to formerly incarcerated people and their employment. And he said to me, well, you know, you get convicted, we take away your right to vote, and that's okay. But we take away the ability for you to work, that's outrageous. I don't agree with him on both points, right? Mm. I think both are outrageous. But if he's willing to work with me on the latter, we don't have to talk about the former ever again. You know, I'll find some other set of allies for that one. I wasn't that way when I was a kid. I would cut you off at the first statement. But my philosophy, I guess, has matured, and it's basically, look, the goal is what's important. The team is going to change as we you know, change goals, and that's quite all right.
Some categorize the making of leaders in 3 ways. A, great people cause great events, or B, movements make leaders, or C, the confluence of unpredictable events creates leaders appropriate for the times. Does one of these fit you, or a combination of these 3? Which is best for you?
Great leaders make great events. What was this?
Great people cause great events. Yeah. Movements make leaders. The confluence of unpredictable events creates leaders appropriate to the times.
I would say the second and the third are appropriate. I very much feel like a child of a human rights movement in this country. Both the civil rights movement of the 20th century and the human rights movement that preceded it, or movements that preceded it, including the movement to abolish slavery. I guess that's the nurture in it. The nature, the reality is that kind of who your parents are and how they meet and who your teachers are and who you bump into, you know, at some point in your life are all feel, you know, they're either completely random or preordained, but whatever, you couldn't. That speaks to me too, sort of confluence and coincidence.
Okay. Do you see your legitimacy as a leader grounded in your ability to persuade people to follow your vision or in your ability to articulate the agenda of a movement?
Both.
Both?
You have to be able to.
One more
both.
Than the other?
I think you have to do the latter to achieve the former. Mm. People have to trust that if we make a decision collectively, that, you know, the CEO or the president or the, you know, the leader or the chairman is going to respect that and be able to articulate that and defend that. At the same time, when you get in the room, those people expect that if they've elected you or chosen you or somebody lined up behind you to lead on something, that you're going to have a vision, that you're going to argue the point, that you're going to push it, you're going to challenge it, and that you will show that same set of skills once the decision's made, you know, in pursuing the agreed upon agenda. I think it's both. I think that if you're so too much, you know, if you're not a company man at all, people find it hard to trust you and to stick with you for very long. But if you're only a company man, it's kind of hard to inspire folks.
Let me ask a couple of questions about race consciousness. How does race consciousness affect your work? Are you a leader who advances issues of race or society or both? Is there a distinction between these? And is there such a thing as a race-transcending leader?
I think we've had race We certainly have had leaders who transformed racism throughout our career, I mean, throughout our history, throughout the centuries in this country. Ed Brooks was just honored in Congress the other day. He was elected, elected to office first in the 1960s in Boston. And people said it was just simply impossible. And he transcended racism. And to me, it's really racism that defines race. I mean, race isn't a scientific, there's no scientific basis. There's just a cultural basis, and the cultural basis is bias. In my own life, I guess I'm both aware, very aware that I'm black, and I've never wanted to be anything else. I mean, it was race is both, I think, something that's fundamentally passive. You're just sort of born, and there's an understanding. In my case, the understanding was that my father knew that his children would be black when he married my mom, both by law at the time, and by the fact that he was being disowned from his extended family. His brother and his mother stood with him, but from his extended family. But it's also something that you affirm. I can remember once being asked by four guys from a book they had done on kind of young black male leaders. Each of us were asked the same question by ABC News, and I was the only one who wasn't shown. We were asked, why is it the toughest thing in America to be a young black man? And the other three had answered the question, just as asked, and I had rejected the premise. And I said, well, anything my experience, my mother and my sisters taught me is that racism and sexism compound each other. So I just don't think that's necessarily so. He said, but also, frankly, I don't know a black person who, if you really gave them the option, would opt to be white. There's a lot of good about being black. Jazz music, hip hop, black women, whatever. There's just a lot of good about being black. And obviously, that wasn't fit for ABC News. But at the same time, race is extremely limiting in creating political consensus in this country. There's been a lot of studies done recently that show that if you lead with racial disparities, you turn off and you harden people against you who are not in the affected group. And I think all of us really yearn to kind of live beyond race. I had experience when I was in Mississippi, I was organizing students, the governor wanted to make the college a prison, and we had decided that we knew where we could find our white allies. They would be at Earth Day. So we sent students to Mississippi State, way up past Philadelphia, up in Starkville, to recruit students at Earth Day. They ended up having a mob of students chant get a rope and chase them off campus. at about 11 o'clock at night, by the time they got back to Jackson, driving on the same highway that has changed very little since Cheney Goodman and Schwerner were kidnapped and killed on it, murdered. They got to the Waffle House in Jackson, and they called me, and they said, we got to talk. So I went over to meet with my organizers, and they explained what had happened. And the whole time, from the counter at the Waffle House, there's this white guy staring at us. And he... you have to understand you tour around the South. I'm sure you've been to a Waffle House or two. Well, usually there's blacks and whites in the same place. There's more of a class cut than a race cut. They don't sit in together, but they're in the same small little diner. Well, we notice as this guy's staring at us, we're the only black people in the restaurant. And he's wearing a loose-fitting shirt. And that's significant because Mississippi's a right-to-carry state. And you can carry a concealed firearm if you don't have a felony with $100. He keeps staring at us. You're also aware that the Klan had put out death threats against us because Byron Della Beckwith had just been put in jail, and we had announced we were having a mass march on the Capitol, and so they said that they would take out one of us because Byron was in jail. And so he comes over to, and this guy, he looked like a used car dealer, but he looked angry. He kept staring at us. He had gold fingers, he had gold rings on every finger. He was wearing a shirt, my grandfather referred to it as a Cuban tuxedo, I don't know if that's right, but it's a white shirt with a little bit of ruffles,
Gabiera.
Yes, a Gabiera. And he comes over to us and he says, all the boys I've been seeing on television, he leans right in our face. They're the only black guys in here, he might be packing a gun. So, yes, sir. Mm-hmm. He said, excuse me for a second. Puts down, Waffle House, these monstrous to-go bags, these grocery bags, turns around, put them down the table, He spins around. Two of the guys sense that he's about to pull out a gun, and they start to jump. I put my hands up like this. And he says, well, I just want to shake your hand. Because if I'd been born a nigger, I'd be mad as hell too. This guy's calling me boy and nigger twice. I'm sorry. None of us. One's from St. Louis, one's from Chicago, you know, one's from New Orleans, I'm from California. None of us guys around the table are accustomed to be calling nigger a boy by some white guy. He said, you all stopped fighting back about 25 years ago. It's 1993. He's talking about 68. He said, I have no idea why. I'm so proud of you. I own the used car lot right down Highway 49. If I can do anything for you, you need money, you need, come see me. I sent the same two fellas who'd been at Mississippi State, thought that they could find their allies, and ran into a lynch mob, or at least some kids masquerading as one, right out to his used car dealership the next day to get a check. For all of us, it was a lesson. I mean, it was so God's affirmation that we had allies that we couldn't perceive easily, that they were there, that we weren't crazy thinking that white people might take up this cause with us, but also reminding us not to be so foolish as to think that we could always predict who they were. And they got the check, and we needed the check at that moment.
You know the great story about the Obama canvassers who are knocking on doors with instructions to engage the homeowner in a little conversation, yeah, and then say, who are you going to vote for? Knock on the door, a woman comes to the door, they chit-chat for a minute, and they say, may we ask you who you're going to vote for? She says, I got to ask my husband. They're a little surprised, and she says, Joe, who are we going to vote for? And Joe shouts from the back of the room, house, we're going to vote for the nigger. And they say, thank you so much. and you got to take your allies where you can find them.
That's exactly right.
Now, do you have a different leadership style when you deal with groups that are all black, mixed race, or all white? Are you different?
I'm different. I think I'm aware. I grew up in a small white town in California, and I spent my summers in the black middle class in West Baltimore. And you had to act differently. I mean, if I called a woman who was older than me in California Mrs., she thought I was insulting her and reminding her that she was old and had wrinkles. If I called a woman who was older than me on the East Coast by her first name, my grandmother hit me in the back of my head, you know? Not hard, but just, you know. And I had a lot of anxiety about that because my grandmother would call them by their first name. I had to remember their last name. I didn't see them for 10 months. But it was a setup. Part of being an organizer is just being aware of who you're talking to and what the kind of cultural norms are, and whether you say Mrs. or whether you say Jane or whether you hug somebody or you shake their hand. But the message is the same, and the sense of urgency is the same, and the sort of willingness to talk about uncomfortable subjects and to challenge people is the same. Right now, we're at a historical moment where all of us need to be thinking about how we talk about issues of race, because one, there's been a lot of black civil rights advocates who've invested a lot of time doing a lot of communication strategy work, and we've learned some things. But also simply because the bigots have been dying very rapidly. A certain generation of people are really hardened, you know. Mm-hmm. There seems to be more people in the middle who could go either way. I mean, you talked about the experience of workers in the primaries. I can never forget folks saying that in engaging independents in New Hampshire, that they had a number of white men cry because they didn't know, they just couldn't decide whether they should vote for Obama or for McCain. Now, obviously, there is a political spectrum that goes far beyond both those men, but they're fairly radically different political choices. There's a lot of people like that in this country, and so while I don't change how I, much other than greetings and so forth, and decorum, how I talk to different groups, I am trying to figure out how to change how I talk to all groups, because I do think that winning our goal in the NAACP, our final goal, which is to really make manifest Lincoln's dream of one nation for everybody, might require that we all change how we talk to everybody.
In challenging the civil rights establishment, the authors quote William Allen, who writes, "There's a danger in continually thinking in terms of race or gender. Until we learn once again to use the language of American freedom in an appropriate way that embraces us all, we're going to continue to harm this country. Do you think there's a danger of divisiveness when we focus on the concept of black leadership?"
Not really. I mean, I think when we tend to do it in a sense that's academic, often that's historical. Or we do it in a moment of crisis, when the crisis is really, you know, like a police shooting. And there's just sort of a notion of kind of cultural obligation that certain people show up. And I think that's all fine. I mean, it's no different than many other ethnic groups. You know, there's a lot of talk right now about all the Catholics on the Supreme Court, for instance. A number of them attended, I think, Mass together recently. What is dangerous is when we talk as if we're only leading black people. We in the NAACP is not a black organization. It's a very black organization, but it's not a black organization. It's a human rights organization. It's a civil rights organization. Our mission is race neutral, but very partisan on ending racism. And I think, you know, that's the opportunity of the moment, and really it's always been there. And really, in some ways, what it's necessitated by has been the utter secularization of progressive language. I read an article in The Nation by a Jewish guy in the mid-90s who was outraged and just finally needed to let progressive Christians know what he thought about them. That we had abandoned the metaphors and the mandates of the Bible in our in our speeches ever since King had died. In his mind, that's when it stopped. I don't know when it stopped, but I know in my entire life it hasn't been very present. There's been a very sort of conscious sort of secularism. And he said, simply, look, this is the most powerful vocabulary that we have in this country. You know, this is how Southern county judges with sort of what might be called socialist leanings were able to, you know, be extremely powerful political figures because they would refer to the lexicon of the Bible and the mandates of the Bible. And they were seen as, therefore, great Christian men and not political, scalawags. And he said, most importantly, I think, to the secular argument, that I was never offended when Dr. King spoke from the perspective of being a Christian. If anything, he affirmed my perspective as a person of faith. It was always understood that my faith was different than his, in some ways connected. But what he was talking about were the sort of the universal truths contained in the great religious works inside and outside the Abrahamic tradition. That's, if we do anything, we have to give ourselves permission to remind people that, you know, Jesus only gave his followers one commandment. It was to love your neighbor as yourself. And everything else is conjecture. What Paul said, or Corinthians, whatever, is conjecture. And to challenge people to make that manifest. You ask, what will Jesus do? You really only have one thing to refer to, which is, you know, and he talks about it, I think, in Matthew, when he talks about the story of the Good Samaritan, right? He just goes back to, are you treating your neighbor as yourself? If you're not, then probably what you're about to do is wrong. If we could get back to that place as progressives in this country, I think we could do a lot to advance a whole bunch of causes that are commonly referred to as wedge issues.
Do you feel black leaders have an obligation to help other African Americans? And is there a point at which that obligation ends and one can pursue his or her own personal political ambitions?
This, for me, I guess, is more just a matter of collective survival. The obligation that we all have, leaders or not, is to extend the ladder of opportunity. The first member of my family who joined the NAACP, Ned Bland, born a slave, died a state senator, very much believed and challenged his children to that for every ounce of privilege that we gain in this country, we're supposed to invest half an ounce in somebody who's less privileged. And so I think any leader, any political leader is just sort of pursuing their own personal gain or getting what they can out of the world while they're alive in a sort of a vain or wealth motivated sense is scandalous if that's what your leadership becomes about. I don't begrudge anybody who accumulates personal wealth, but there isn't an obligation to use that wealth to give other people, if nothing else, the same opportunity.
What do you see as your greatest contribution as an African American leader?
I think ultimately giving voice and winning a few victories here and there, whether it was helping to start an ultimately successful campaign to abolish the juvenile death penalty or the Troy Davis case, so individual cases and policies. To my generation's pain and frustration that comes out of starting our lives being told that as the children of the dream, something once called us, a poet once called us, these kids who were born as and just after the great civil rights victories were being won, that playing field was now fair, study hard, apply yourself, you'll do well. And both finding that true for many of us, very much true for me, for instance, and yet having so many of our peers killed and sent off to prison. We came of age, right, just in time to find ourselves the most murdered generation in this country, the most incarcerated generation on the planet. And there's a profound sense of betrayal in that, and everything that goes with it, including the squandering of public resources and the failure of schools. And I think my greatest contribution has been to continually and give voice to that sense of angst and frustration and the hope for the country that's inside of it, the hope that we can get beyond this. If we can just get beyond this, then maybe we can really realize, what our parents and our grandparents set out, to truly make manifest for all of us.
Cornel West writes, "The crisis of leadership is a symptom of black distance from a vibrant tradition of resistance, from a vital community bonded by ethical ideals, and from a credible sense of political struggle." Do you think there's a crisis in black leadership and communities today? And if there is, if you think so, what makes that so?
Yes and no. I think that there's a crisis in our communities that comes from the physical distance between the black middle class and black people who are struggling in their everyday lives. And it plays out in many ways, in some ways quite personal. There was a study done in the 90s on the spike in black teen suicide, and what it came down to, that it wasn't the black kids in the inner city who had access to guns who were killing themselves more frequently. It was the privileged black kids in the suburbs who were lonely, who were more socially isolated than any group of black children had ever been, because they were so far away from the sort of agrarian norm that either we experienced in the rural South or we replicated in the inner city, that they were just the most profoundly isolated, socially isolated group of black children ever born in this country. On the other extreme is that, you stand in central Harlem the mid-90s when I was an organizer, you didn't miss white people. It wasn't white flight you were concerned about. You missed middle-class black people. You missed the people who came in their big cars on the weekends to church and got out of there as quickly as possible because they didn't want to get mugged. And in that phenomenon is a certain disconnectedness. And the danger at this point in our history is that if we don't recommit, whether it's to the NAACP, whether it's to a black church in the inner city where our family had gone to historically, if we don't recommit to maintaining that sense of connectedness, we're only two generations. What the suicide studies showed was that simply what was happening to black children in the 90s had happened to white kids in the 50s. We're just two generations behind white families and sort of the nuclearization and suburbanization of middle-class families and the atomization of families. And the poor cousins don't know the rich cousins. And when that happens, leadership fundamentally changes because the sense of obligation to advocate for people less fortunate diminishes when you no longer see those people as being part of your family and sharing a blood connection with you.
What kind of leaders does contemporary society demand? How will future problems demand different leadership styles?
Society demands that leaders put race behind us, and they, in engaging the larger public, and find ways to encourage society to do the same. We've made about as much progress as we can make in this country without moving beyond racism. Race and ethnic identity are very important. People's sense of self and being grounded and connected to a broader community. But these silly notions that one group is more criminalistic or mentally inferior or mentally superior or pristine because of the color of their skin is ridiculous. And we know scientifically it's as ridiculous as hair color or eye color. And yet we still permit ourselves to fixate it and for it to imbue our politics and our corporate hiring decisions. It's in this country, there's a study by a woman at Princeton, Devah Pager, said it was harder for a black man with no criminal record to get a job than a white man with a criminal record. It should be deeply disturbing to everybody. One of the best leaders I saw in encouraging people and leading people out of this tradition, my life, was Jack Kemp. I saw Jack give a I was aware of kind of all the things he had done as a football player and an early athlete, and his comments that, he's never had any problem fighting for the guys that he used to have to shower with. And just talking about the humanity between football players, how it changes politics. But I saw him stand up in South Central Los Angeles to a group of black folks and give a speech about our kids. And he was clearly talking about kids just like two blocks away at the local failing school. Our kids, our kids, our kids. And I'm sitting there then as the head of the Trade Association of Black Newspapers looking at him going, whose kids are you talking about? Is he talking about? Does Jack have kids in South LA? And then correcting myself and saying, oh, of course. He's talking about, we're Americans. They are all our kids. It's a struggle in my own life, but it's something I think all of us, whether you're a Republican like white Republican like Jack Kemp or black independent and Democrat like myself, I vacillate in those two. Get frustrated with the Democrats sometimes. We have to challenge ourselves because race, the contours of racism in our society ultimately are things that too many of us find comfort in.
As a society, how can we foster the most effective leaders for the future?
One is by insisting that people learn how to lead before they learn how to manage. A lot of people who, we train them in Robert's Rules of Order, and we train them in sort of all sorts of management techniques, and we haven't forced them to figure out how to lead first. So I think we need to throw more of our young people out of the nest. When I went to go see Jesse Jackson's, when I went to the meeting, I told my dad when I was 14, look, I want to go to this meeting that they're having about Jesse Jackson's campaign. He said, sure, I'd be happy to take you. I was planning on going myself. I'm sitting there at the meeting, and they're saying, oh, and we need somebody to organize the high school students to help with the voter registration drive. And they had a vision of having students really drive that. And I was kind of looking around waiting. My dad said, oh, Ben, you're the only high school student in the room. And I said, okay, I'll do it. And that was his way of just saying, get out and just go do it. But fundamentally, that's a decision I had to make for myself, and people need to make for themselves. So I think young people have an obligation. My pastor did a similar thing for me when I was 19, and I was in Harlem. I was referring to myself as a student organizer. And he said, why are you going to stop sort of qualifying the type of organizer you are? And he took me out on the porch of the farmhouse that is our rectory at St. Mary's Church in Harlem, and he pointed to the 26th precinct right across the street, the police precinct. And he said, son, depending on the crime, when you're 14, they'll consider you to be an adult. You need to understand that you're 19 and you are an adult. You aren't a student organizer. You are you know, youth organizer. That might be who you're organizing today, but you're an organizer, and you have the responsibilities to behave like one, and frankly, when you talk about having a bigger vision for society and not just being fixated on campus issues. And he said, now you know, let's get back to the meeting. I think that we develop all these systems for training people, young people to be leaders, and a lot of times we're just training them to manage. And leadership takes courage, both on the part of the young person and on the part of the chaperone or the mentor or whatever, to just say, get out the nest. Go do it.
Ms. Jealous, thank you.
Thank you.